delighted that you're here. I hope that you've had a very enjoyable Sunday afternoon and that the activities of the day have refreshed your mind and you're eager now to take your Bibles and study with us as we talk about things that have to do with serving God and going to heaven in the after a while. We talked this morning about the problem of self, and we suggest by that there are many other problems that man has. And I know of no problem that a person has that pulls more at his heart and his heartstrings like family problems pull at his heart. It may begin with problems in the marriage, and it may result in the problems that they have in raising and the rearing of their children. And I want to begin our study tonight by establishing about three principles with reference to marriage problems. First of all, let's understand that marriages sometimes have problems. So number one, sometimes marriages have problems. It doesn't have to be to the point of divorce in order for it to be a problem. It doesn't have to be a major problem for it to be a problem. Sometimes people say, well, we don't really have any problems in our marriage. And what they mean by that, we don't have any major problem. We don't have anything that's bringing us apart at the seams. But marriages sometimes have problems. And that's the thing we need to understand. The problem might be temporary, that only lasts for a day or for a few hours even. Or it may be something that lasts for years. It may be something that seems so insignificant it's hardly worth mentioning. Or it may be something wherein you think you need to seek counseling. But marriages sometimes have problems. Secondly, marriage problems have solutions. Marriage problems have solutions. If that's not the case, then no one could be blamed for the problems. Can you imagine? That here is a couple having problems, but you say, well, there is no solution to that. We can't really blame either one because there's nothing either one can do to resolve that. Well, it's obvious that marriage problems have solution. In any passage that talks about what the marriage ought to be, in any passage that talks about what the husband should be or the wife should be, is a passage that says that those marriage problems have solutions. And that means that if both parties try, the problems can be fixed, they could be worked out, and they can have a great marriage. So here's the third thing we need to establish. Solutions have to be sought to marriage problems. Solutions have to be sought for marriage problems. If not, then the problem gets worse, it gets bigger and out of hand. It hinders our whole service unto God. And I think that's the point of 1 Peter 3:7. That if the husband doesn't dwell with his wife according to knowledge, and he doesn't treat her as an heir together of the grace of life, and as the weaker vessel, his prayers are hindered. It doesn't mean that everything else is acceptable, but he just can't pray. But it stands for his whole service to God is hindered. And so here's the three things that we've established. Marriages sometimes have problems, number one. Marriage problems have solutions, number two. And we have to seek after those solutions. They don't just come and hit us in the face. Now we can better understand why there are problems and why there can be answers to those problems when we understand who is involved in the marriage relationship. So let's turn in our Bible, starting with Malachi. We'll look at two passages, one from the Old Testament and one from the New. Let's turn in our Old Testament to Malachi 2. And in Malachi 2 and in verse 14, I noticed that there was a problem that was going on. In fact, two problems in Malachi with reference to marriage. They were divorcing those to whom they should have remained married, and they were marrying those to whom they had no right to be married. Sounds like 2000, doesn't it? Sounds like our modern day. But nonetheless, that was a problem they were having with reference to marriage. And so he says in Malachi 2 and in verse 14, he says, "For what reason? Because the Lord hath been witness between you and the wife of your youth, with whom you've dealt treacherously. She is your companion and your wife by covenant." Now what I learned from that is that she is your wife by covenant. There is someone else involved in the marriage relationship. Now there's another passage I want us to consider, and then we'll draw our conclusion. And that's in Romans chapter 7. Turn there with me, if you will, to verses 2 and 3. And in Romans 7, verses 2 and 3, the text says, "For a woman which hath a husband is bound by the law to her husband so long as he liveth." And now verse 3 says, "So then if," that is, basing the points that he makes in verse 3 upon the principle of verse 2, "so then if while her husband liveth, she be married to another man, she should be called an adulteress." But the point I want you to notice is in verse 2. That a woman which hath a husband is bound by the law, that is God's law, to her husband so long as he liveth. Now here's what I learned from Romans chapter 2, or Romans chapter 7 verses 2 and 3, and Malachi chapter 2 and 14. And that is that there are three beings in the marriage relationship. Quite often people view their marriage as only involving two people. They think that it involves a man and his wife, and that's all that's involved. And so whatever they want to do with the marriage relationship, then that's okay, and it's no one else's business. After all, if they want to fuss and fight all the time, in fact, they may enjoy fighting all the time. And if they want to do that, then whose business is that? Let them do that, in other words. Or if they decide they want to bring an end to that marriage relationship and sever that and go, and they are mutually agreeable to that, go their separate ways, then whose business is that? After all, it's just the two of them that's involved in the marriage relationship. But these passages we've just noticed tell me that it involves a man and his wife, but God is also involved in that marriage relationship. Now, she is his wife by covenant. This man is her husband by covenant, a covenant that is made with God. And furthermore, Romans chapter 7 said that there are three involved in that, because she is bound by the law of God to her husband. And Matthew chapter 19 and verse 6 says that it is God who has joined them together. So those three passages tell me that there are three beings involved in the marriage relationship. It involves God, it involves man, and his wife. And so if we take the husband away from that marriage relationship, we don't have a right to do that. But if we take God away from that relationship, neither do we have a right to do that either, because God, in the marriage relationship, pronounced that three are involved in the marriage relationship. Now, when that's true, then that explains some things for me. When I understand that marriage involves a man and his wife, and I also understand that marriage involves God, that tells me why there are problems, and it tells me how there could be answers. We want to look at two points in our study tonight. I want us to see that marriage involves two people, therefore there will be problems. Now, why do we have problems in marriage? Because it involves two people. If it involves two people, there might not be problems. Because two people are involved, that's why there are problems sometimes in marriage. But there are answers to that marriage, because marriage involves God. So marriage involves people, there will be problems. Marriage involves God, there are answers to those problems. And let us consider now, for the first part of our study, the fact that there are two people involved in that marriage relationship. So therefore, there is the potential for problems. Now, in the first part of our study, I'm not so much concerned in this part of our study with giving answers, though we will give some. We'll do that in the second part of our study. I'm mainly concerned at this point of describing the potential areas for problems. And so as we deal with some of these, we may just describe a problem, not give much answer. That'll come in the second part of our study. But I want us to see, because marriage involves two people, it involves a man and his wife, there will be problems, and there's potential for problems in a number of areas. And let's take each one of these and see some potential problems. Because they come from different families. That is, he was raised by one set of parents, she was raised by a different set of parents. They have different customs. They have different personalities. They have different interests, different goals. Maybe different spiritual background. Because they come from two different families, there is the potential for parental interference in that marriage relationship, particularly at the beginning of that marriage relationship. The parents of each one may want to continue to have influence on the marriage and the decisions that the couple make. And that's natural, because parents are interested in the welfare of their children. They want only what's best, and they think they know what's best, and they may do that. That is, they may know what is best, and consequently they want to have some influence. It is easy for parents to put pressure on a relationship. That is, here is a new couple that has entered into a marriage relationship. It is very easy for parents to want to put pressure on them to make that marriage what they think it ought to be. Sometimes the child of the parent who interferes is torn between loyalty to the parent and at the same time loyalty to his or her mate. The in-law in the case may build resentment against those parents who are trying to interfere. So because they came from two different families, there is the potential for parental interference. Let's turn to Matthew, the 19th chapter. And notice what Jesus said about the marriage relationship. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 19 in verse 4, "For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh." Now what I want you to notice in Matthew chapter 19, 4 through 6, though I did not quote all of that, is that a husband and wife should leave their father and mother, and they should cleave unto each other. That is, apron strings must be cut. That is, they must not allow their parents to run or ruin their marriage relationship. And I learned from that text and others that this marriage relationship constitutes a new home and a new family. It may be that this man who has just entered this marriage and this woman who has just entered this marriage relationship, it may be that he is not as wise as her father or as his father. It may be that he doesn't have the insight to the family relationship that his mother has or that her mother has. But God placed him as the head of the new family. And here's how I know that. In Ephesians chapter 5, God said so. You see, in this new marriage relationship, God said he is the head of the wife. He is the head of the new family relationship. They've begun a new family relationship when they entered into the marriage relationship. And he may not have that understanding and wisdom and knowledge that his father or her father has. But he's the head of this new family because God placed him in that position and God placed him in that relationship. You may come to the point, because of parental interference, that these two people who form this new marriage relationship may have to sit down with the parent that interferes and say, we appreciate your advice, we love you and appreciate you, but we're not going to allow you to run or ruin this marriage relationship. This is a relationship where God placed him as the head of the family relationship, placed him as being the leader. Now, because there are two people involved, that means they have different minds. And because they have different minds, there is the potential for communication problems. There's the potential for communication problems. Marriages fail from a lack of communication. But as many marriages fail, when you look at a marriage that has come apart, you may begin to blame it on this problem or that problem or some other problem. But when you get right to the root of it, you may find that some of the real problem was there was a lack of communication between the two. And it suggests some forms in which that may be found. With one marriage, their lack of communication is seen in that they don't bond or get to know one another. Have you ever seen a married couple that just don't ever seem like they gel with each other? It seems as if they never got to know one another. And so they're not communicating. They're not getting to know one another. They don't seem to bond. For another marriage relationship, their lack of communication may be seen in that they live separate lives. He goes in his direction and does his own thing. She goes in her direction and does her own thing. They never seem to go in any direction together. And so they live separate lives. They never seem to communicate much. For a third couple, it may be that their lack of communication involves fussing and nagging and pouting rather than discussing. They have differences to arise, as all married couples do. But when they have differences to arise, they just pout about that. Or maybe they go in separate rooms, or maybe they storm off mad. And they pout and they fuss, or they nag each other rather than sitting down calmly discussing their differences and their problems. For another couple, it may be they just refuse to talk about sensitive subjects. How many times have you known of a wife to say, I can't mention that to my husband. That's just an area where I can't bring that up. Or maybe he mentions that about his wife. I want to suggest to you that any successful relationship demands effective communication. In the latter part of our study, we're going to talk about some effective principles or some of the principles that are involved in communication. Suffice it to say here that when we learn to communicate effectively, here are some goals or some things that we accomplish. Let me list four of those. Number one, we prevent misunderstandings. That is, when we effectively communicate in a marriage relationship, that prevents misunderstandings. Secondly, what is accomplished is we discuss and resolve our differences. If this man and woman who are married to each other, though there's potential communication problems, if they learn to communicate effectively, they're going to resolve their differences by discussion rather than having a standoff. Here's a third thing that is accomplished. They're going to agree before they act. How many times have you known of a wife to be upset and she's mad because her husband did something that he didn't discuss with her, or vice versa? And one of them has done something major. They've made a major decision. Maybe it's a major financial decision that the other did not know anything about, and they didn't agree upon that before they acted. Communication means that you'll agree before you act. And fourthly, what is accomplished when you communicate is you grow closer together. Isn't that true in any relationship? When they're friends, not involving a marriage relationship, when they're people who are just friends, the more they communicate with each other, the closer their bond is. And the same thing is true in a marriage relationship. That's true among brethren, too. The more we communicate with our brethren, we grow closer together with each one another. There is a third area. Because there are two people involved, that may mean that they have different religions. It's not always the case. But it may be that they have different religions from which they come, and so there is the potential for religious conflict. When you marry a non-Christian, a weak Christian, or an erring Christian, there are some problems that could be incurred. And I want to suggest to you three or four problems that could be incurred. Quite often people, when they're looking for someone to date, they start dating someone who does not share the same religious principles that they share. And they think nothing is wrong with that. There's no problem with that. There's no sin involved, I will agree. But they see no dangers involved in that. The next thing you know, they've fallen in love. And after falling in love, they decide they're going to get married. And after they decide to get married, it's beginning to be too late to understand some of the differences. But let me suggest to you some of the problems that come when you marry a non-Christian, a weak Christian, or an erring Christian. Number one, the closest one to you on earth, that's your mate. Because Jesus said that you're one flesh. The one that you're closest to on earth is the person that you do not share what is most important to you in your life, and that's your relationship to God. When you think about that, the one that you love the most, the one that you're closest to on earth, you do not share what is most important to you. And that's your relationship to God and your service to God. Here's a second problem you'll face when you marry a non-Christian, an erring Christian or a weak Christian. And that is their lack of spirituality or their wrong direction of spirituality causes you concern for his or her soul. And so you're concerned about how they may be reached. That was the whole point in 1 Peter chapter 3. Just turn briefly there with me, if you will. We're not going to spend any time reading from 1 Peter 3, but noticing a principle that in verse 1, the whole problem with this wife here is that she's concerned how she may win her husband without the word, that is, without preaching to him and without nagging him. How can she somehow win him to the cause of Christ? She's concerned for his soul. This text may also suggest that those efforts to reach your mate may be met with resentment. These are just some potential problems that you face. The one you're closest to, you do not share what's most important. Secondly, the concern that you have for his or her soul and the efforts to reach them. Here's a third potential problem. How are you going to raise the kids become an issue? How are you going to raise the kids when you agree together on Bible principles? There is no problem. But when you don't agree together on Bible principles, then what about the question of are you going to spank the kids? You know, the Bible teaches spanking. In Proverbs chapter 22:15, foolishness is bound in the heart of the child, but the rod, by the way, the word rod is what the idea of what we think of as a switch. It's a branch is the idea, if we look at literally in Hebrew. And so it has the idea of foolishness is bound in the heart of the child, but the rod will drive it far from him. Are you going to fulfill that principle in rearing your children, or suppose your mate, because they're not a Christian, decides that they don't think that's right? They don't think you ought to spank children. What are you going to do? And what are you going to do about the question of immodesty and dancing and indecent movies when your mate may approve of those kinds of things? How are you going to teach your children those things are wrong when your mate is telling them it's okay? What are you going to do about making your children go to church when your mate doesn't go with you and your mate tells them it's all right? And what are you going to teach them when you do take them to church? And when you sit down about Bible lessons, are you going to teach them the truth, or are you going to teach them denominational error that your mate may believe? And that your mate may be trying to teach them as well. Here's another potential problem. When differences arise, how are you going to settle your differences if there's no common respect for the word? You see, when two people, when this man and this woman are married to each other and they're both faithful children of God, they both have the same respect for God and for his word. When they have differences, they can sit down and say that we want to settle our differences in light of the word of God. We want to act like Christians here. And whatever God has said, that's what we will do. But suppose your mate doesn't have that same respect for the word. And suppose part of the difference is that the wife doesn't want to submit. Now, maybe she's the non-Christian and she doesn't want to submit. Or maybe he doesn't want to lead. And what are you going to do about that? Looking at the word may not have any impact because they don't have that same respect for the word. These are some potential problems we have in marriage when we marry a non-Christian, erring Christian, or a weak Christian. Let's turn in our Bible, Deuteronomy chapter 7, and notice a warning given in Deuteronomy 7. I recognize this is Old Testament principle, and this is not bound upon us as New Testament principle, but it gives us a warning of the dangers of marrying those who do not have the same respect for God. And here's the fifth problem that we're dealing with, and that is the non-Christian may weaken you spiritually. Statistics shows that that's the case. In many cases, or in many relationships where a Christian marries a non-Christian, the Christian will convert the non-Christian. But statistics show then what generally happens is the non-Christian leads the Christian astray and weakens them spiritually. Here's the warning of Deuteronomy 7. Deuteronomy 7 warned the people when they entered the land of Canaan, don't marry the people of the land. Don't marry the Canaanites, Hittites, and Jebusites, and on down the line. Don't marry any of those people. Now why? Well, notice verse 3, neither shall you make marriages with them. For verse 4, for they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods.
Now recognize that's not New Testament principle. I'm not binding it as principle. But the warning is that when you marry those who do not have the same respect for God, they could easily lead you away from God. That happened numerous times through the Bible. One classic case is Nehemiah chapter 13. So what I'm suggesting to you is that when they come from different religious backgrounds, they may have different religions, there is the potential for religious conflict. Now how could you avoid that? Listen to me carefully as I suggest to you that you need to marry a person who fears God. Like Nehemiah's brother who feared God more than many, Nehemiah 7 and verse 2. Now one who fears God is far more than one who happens to be baptized and one who happens to be a member of the Church of Christ and one who goes to church all of the time. I've been teaching my children for a number of years. And so we would have Bible study and at home and do our Bible lessons. And the occasion would arise that I teach them that I want you to understand the need for marrying a person who fears God. And I tell them that I don't want you to marry just a Christian. That's not enough. That's not good enough to marry a Christian. It's not good enough to marry a member of the Church of Christ. Marry a person who fears God. That involves far more than to happen to be a member of the Church of Christ. A person who holds God in the fear. That is, he has awe and respect for God and he's afraid of displeasing God. And when you marry a person who fears God, then these religious conflicts can be avoided because they share that same concept of God and His Word. But here's something else. Because they are of different sexes, they're different people. There's a man and woman involved, they're different sexes, there's the potential for sexual conflict. Do you realize that when you look at the causes of divorce, look at any statistics for any state or the nation, for the causes of divorce, when you look at the number of causes for divorce, right at the top of every list, I don't mean number one, but I mean in the top two or three, of every list that you'll consider will always be a conflict over two things. One is the conflict over the intimate relationship, and the other is over financial matters. And both of those involve a lack of communication, and then all of that involves something else that we'll talk about in our second part of our study. But that's always in every list I've ever seen. There's a conflict over those relationships that's always in the top of the list somewhere. That doesn't mean every marriage breaks up over that, but it means it's a serious problem in married relationships and the problems they incur. Now, how can that come? Well, first of all, it may come in the form of one mate being unfaithful and committing adultery, like Jesus talked about in Matthew 19 and verse 9. Another form of that conflict may come when one is unwilling to render the conjugal rights of 1 Corinthians 7 verses 3 and 4. Or it may come in the form of one of the mates being inconsiderate or unloving or being unreasonable about that relationship. But whatever the problem may be, it may be that there is a conflict over sexual conflict and therefore there is that potential of a problem arising. Now, here are some Bible principles about that. Hebrews chapter 13 in verse 4. We need to understand that that is a relationship that God designed for the married relationship, and it is not before or after the marriage relationship. Hebrews 13 and verse 4. Marriage is honorable and the bed undefiled. But he said the fornicator and the adulterer God will judge. And furthermore, that is a relationship that demands some communication and some understanding. Like 1 Peter 3, 7. The husband is to dwell with his wife according to understanding. They need to have communication over that relationship. They need to have understanding of each other and their responsibilities and their needs. And that will resolve some of the differences they have. Now, because God has given them different roles in their relationship, there is the potential for conflict over leadership. It may come in the form of the husband not willing to fulfill his role or the wife not fulfilling her role. Let's consider what their roles are in Ephesians chapter 5. In Ephesians chapter 5, the text tells us that the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body, Ephesians 5, 22 and 23. Now, the husband is said to be the head of the wife. That doesn't mean he's the boss of the relationship. That doesn't mean he's the commander-in-chief of the relationship. It gives him the responsibility of leadership. That's the idea of his being head. It more directs his responsibility than it does his great authority and his commanding ability. He is the leader in the relationship. And so he is to lead and he's to guide and he's responsible for both him and the wife in the relationship. But that same text tells me that the wife is to be submissive. That takes self-denial and self-control, where she suppresses her own will and yields to the direction and the leadership of her husband. 1 Peter 3 tells me that the wife is to be submissive to her husband, and it tells me why she's to do that. She does that because she trusts in God, verse 5. She submits, this woman of 1 Peter 3, verses 1 through 6, she submits to her husband not because he's the best husband. She submits to her husband because of her confidence and her trust and her fear of God. Now in verse 6 of that same context, he tells me that Sarah called Abraham Lord. In what sense? Not that she is bowing down before him as some god, but he is her leader. He is her ruler in the sense that he is the Lord, that is Lord in the sense that he is the leader of the relationship. That's the sense in which she called him Lord. Now that conflict may come because the husband is unwilling to lead. Have you ever known of a husband who didn't want the responsibility? I've known of numerous husbands who really wanted to put that responsibility off on the wife because he didn't want the blame. Not only did he not want credit when things went right, he didn't want the blame when things went wrong. And so he pushes it off on the wife and wants her to be the leader, her to make the decisions. Major decisions. So if it goes wrong, he can blame her for that. On the other hand, it may be that there is a domineering husband over his wife. Maybe he thinks of it as a boss or a master-slave relationship. Or maybe the wife is domineering over the husband, or maybe she will not submit to his leadership. And so there is a conflict because of different roles that they have been given. They both must be willing to follow God's plan. But here's another area where there's a potential for conflict. They may have different views of money. And therefore, there is the potential for money problems. Now, a moment ago I said every list I've ever seen lists two causes right at the top, one, two, or three. One of them is the intimate relationship, differences in that relationship. The other thing that's always at the top is differences over financial matters. Differences over financial matters. It may be that they both spend more than they make. It may be that one is selfish in their spending. It may be that the husband spends it all on himself and he begrudges her spending anything on herself, or maybe she's doing all the spending and he's not getting anything. Maybe they're both spending more than they make, and the pressures of debt and the bill collectors and the way the other mate spends, or the lack of planning or the lack of saving, is causing friction and is causing fights. We noticed this morning two passages that are quite important when it comes to financial matters. Romans 13 and verse 8, owe no man anything but to love. That is, all the debt you have you're to be able to pay, except this one you'll never fully pay off, and that's the debt to love. So live within your means, in other words. And then Proverbs chapter 22, 17 says, the borrower is servant to the lender. Now, because there are two people involved, there is the potential for parental interference, for communication problems, religious conflict, sexual conflict, conflict over leadership, and money problems. So because two people are involved, there will be problems in the marriage relationship. Now, the marriage relationship also involves God. And because God is involved, there have to be answers to the problems. Remember the three beings involved? Because God is involved, there are some answers to those problems. Now let's consider what the answers are as we talk about the answers that are involved in the marriage problems we have. I want to look at three things. These are not exhaustive. I want to look at three principles that when we apply these to the marriage relationship, they will prevent, number one, a number of problems. There will be problems to arise in spite of our application of these principles, but when they do, we make a greater degree of application of all three of these principles, and we can resolve our differences and our problems. Whether it be over the relationship, whether it be over money, whether it be over the parental interference, whatever it may be, if we apply these principles to the marriage relationship, our problems can be solved. First of all, let's talk about making a commitment. That is, when this couple enter into a marriage relationship, they make a commitment in two areas. Number one, they make a commitment to God, and secondly, they make a commitment to their mate. Let's talk about this commitment to God. In Proverbs chapter 2, let's talk about the strange woman there. This is the harlot of Proverbs 2. The warning is given in Proverbs 2, given again in 5 and in 6 and in 7, concerning the harlot. But one of the things that's wrong with her is that she forsakes the companion of her youth and forgets the covenant of her God. Now, when she does something that is detrimental to this relationship, this husband-wife relationship, she is forsaking the covenant of the companion of her youth. That is, she's forsaking her mate. But not only that, she is forsaking a covenant that she has with God. So we make a commitment to God, first of all, when we become children of God. We make a commitment to God when we enter the marriage relationship that we're going to honor His word and His law on the marriage. And whatever God has directed on the marriage, that's what we've pledged to do. So in our commitment to God, that is a commitment to follow His word, whatever it says on the marriage relationship. Our commitment to God is why we treat our mates the way we should. Our commitment to God is why we fulfill our roles. Remember that from 1 Peter 3? Now this woman of 1 Peter 3 is submissive to her husband. Why? Not because he's the best husband. He couldn't be. He's not a Christian. She submitted to her husband because she trusted in God, verse 5. And so it's her faithfulness to God is why she submits to her husband. It's why we fulfill our roles. It's why we work our problems out. It's why we seek the best and to please our mates. is because of a commitment, first of all, we've made to our God. It means, furthermore, that we let God decide the things of the marriage relationship, and God define our roles and our responsibilities. We let God decide who will be the head. And we let God decide who will submit, and we let God decide who will keep house, and we let God decide who will make the living. We let God make the decisions about the marriage relationship because of a commitment we made to God. Suppose now this couple comes along and they decide that they want to do things different, and they want her to be the head of the relationship, and he'll submit because she seems to have a better head for direction of the family, and she's going to be the leader in the family. They're not going to do that, though, because they've made, first of all, a commitment to God, that God, whatever you said in your word, we're going to follow your word. That's a commitment they make to God. Can you see how that answers most of the problems we have in the marriage? When we make a commitment that we're going to follow after God, but first of all, we make a commitment to our mates. Matthew chapter 19. Jesus said that man should leave his father and mother and should cleave unto his mate. Let's talk about the word cleave. The word cleave means to join fast together, to glue or to cement. It is primarily said of metals, Vine says, and other materials from collar, which means glue. Now what he's saying in that is that the word cleave to your mate comes from a word from which we get the idea of gluing together, gluing something together. You ever use carpenters glue and glue two pieces of wood together? Any craftsman knows that if you properly glue those, that they become inseparable. Now they're one, if they're done right. And if it comes back apart, you didn't do it right. But if you do it properly and you do it right, they become inseparable. Now they're one, they're glued together. Different from the concept of Velcro, where you put something together with Velcro, it's intended to come back apart and then put back together and come back apart whenever you want, when the convenience is to put it together, take it back apart. But that's not the idea of glue. When you properly glue something together, it's stuck together. It is also used of metals, Vine says. What we would think of as welding metals together. You take one piece of metal and you weld it to another, now they've become one, and they are inseparable. You don't intend to take them apart, or you wouldn't be welding those together, would you? And the concept of welding together or gluing together is the word that's involved here of cleaving to your mate. So he's saying that a husband and wife are glued or welded together. What does that mean? Well, because of that, that's why they stay together through thick and through thin. That's why they make their mates happy. That's why they give themselves to their mates. And that's why they view their marriage as being one and not two separate lives. I like what Matthew Henry said on Matthew 19. He said, a man's children are pieces of himself, but a man's wife is himself. I like that. A man's children are just pieces of himself, but a man's wife is himself because they are one flesh. They are cleaving together. That's the idea of being one. And so what do we do, first of all, to solve our marriage problems? Make a commitment, first of all, to God, and a commitment to our mate. Here's a second thing that we talked about this morning, and that is denying self. Let's open our Bibles to Mark 8:34. It may be that you've never thought much about Mark 8:34 having any direct application on the marriage relationship. But here is what Jesus is saying in Mark 8:34. Whoever desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. If I might paraphrase, as I did this morning, what Jesus is saying is that if you want to be my disciple, if you want to be a faithful Christian, if you want to be my follower, learn this principle of denying self. What does that mean? This morning we pointed out that means literally saying no to yourself. It involves getting a grip on yourself and making yourself do what you know you need to do. Those were just two simple definitions we gave. Now, when we deny ourselves, what that means is, here's how that applies to the marriage relationship. Can you imagine that the beauty of this relationship when each of them are both saying no to themselves? How many times when there's been a conflict in the marriage relationship, the problem is because one or both of them are saying, this is what I want. How many times when the argument exists between the two, they're talking about me and I and how I feel and what I want. We see what Jesus is saying in Mark 8:34. If we learn this principle, and we learn to say no to ourselves, and showing greater interest in our mate, can you see how that resolves a lot of differences? Here's the husband, if he applies that principle, when there's something, a conflict between him and his wife, he's going to say no to himself and show an interest in what she wants and what she desires. But she'll be doing the same thing. See how that applies to the relationship? It means they both will yield to the will of God. Self-denial means you suppress your own will and your own desires and you yield to the will of God, particularly with reference to the marriage relationship. It may go back to this principle. He says, you know what? I really don't like to leave. But you know what he's going to do? He's going to suppress that will and yield to the will of God, and he'll leave nonetheless, because that's what God said. And it may be that one or more of them say, you know, I don't like this idea of God telling us we have to have this conjugal relationship. But they'll suppress their own will and yield to the will of God. Or it may be some other area of the marriage relationship. That I'd like to live beyond my means and live in debt, because that seems to be funner. But they'll suppress their own will and yield to the will of God, whatever it may be. And that means, furthermore, that they'll make themselves do what they know they should. When he looks at his relationship, he's not going to be saying, you know what, I know as a husband I need to do. He's just going to do it. And she's not going to be saying, you know what, I need to be a better wife. I know that to be a better wife, what I need to be doing. She's not going to be saying that. She's just going to do it, because she's denying self. And she has control of herself and got a grip on herself and making herself do that. Can you see how that applies to the marriage relationship? Let me ask you a question. For emphasis, can you think of a marriage problem that does not involve a lack of self-denial somewhere on the part of one or both? Can you think of one? Can you think of a marriage problem that does not involve a lack of self-denial and self-control? I can't think of one. Let me tell you about a book I saw a few years ago that had a profound impact upon my thinking on marriage. Went into a religious bookstore, and I'd already made my purchase, and so I wasn't going to buy anymore. And as I go out the door, I noticed there's a display of a new book on just as you go out the door. And this big display said something about this book is dealing with, and the cover said, Solving Marriage Problems, I believe was the title of it. And I picked the book up, and what I noticed about the book is that every page looked very similar. Every page had a line right across the middle of the page. And at the top of the page was the problem, marriage problem, and at the bottom of the page was the answer to the problem. The top of every page was different, about 150 pages, I suppose, in the book, and every page had a different problem. Page one had a problem, but page two had a different problem. And on down the line, each one was a different problem. But what was unique about the book is that the bottom of every page was identical, not similar, but identical. It just had one line, and it said, answer to whatever the problem was. Throughout the book, 150 different problems, the answer was C, Mark 8:34. Well, I threw the book back because I thought, I don't need a book that tells me the problems. I want a book that gives me the answers. And I've got Mark 8:34 in the New Testament. I don't need the book. And the more I thought about it, you know, that is the answer to marriage problems. Can you think of a marriage problem that does not involve a lack of self-denial or self-control? I can't think of one. Let me illustrate that for you. Here are a list of problems. We won't go through each one in great detail, but let's talk about some of the problems that may occur in a marriage relationship. And I want you to notice that with each one of these, it always involves one of both parties not denying themselves. Well, it may start with financial difficulties. It may be that they're up to their necks in debt. Why are they up to their necks in debt? Because one or both of them were not denying self. They wanted some things that they couldn't afford, and that's why they have them now, and that's why they're in debt. You see how financial problems and difficulties came about because of somebody not denying self. Now, there may be some exception to that. I'm not talking about where they got into financial ruin because of sickness or health and financial bills ran up because of diet. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about where they get into the problem of they've charged and they've bought more than they can afford. Or can you see where maybe one is not being submissive and the other is being domineering? Why do they have that problem? Because one or both parties are not denying themselves. She would be submissive if she denied herself, and he would not be domineering if he denied himself. But it may be sexual disagreement. It may be a lack of communication. They say, I'll tell you what our problem was in this marriage. We just never talked with each other. It wasn't self-denial. It was what that we just didn't communicate. You see, they would have learned to communicate if they learned to deny themselves. You know, he may say, well, I'll tell you what. I'm just not one that's much for talking. I just tell you, I've never been one to express my feelings. I've never been one to communicate to my wife. That's just the way I was raised. Well, if you know you need to communicate, then make yourself do that as part of self-denial and self-control. Or it may be that one of them is lazy. He wouldn't be lazy if he denied himself. Or maybe he's no help with the children. She's just frustrated that he is no help with taking care of the young kids. Well, he would help if he denied himself. Maybe they don't have time for each other. They would if they denied themselves. Maybe she's complaining because he has no initiative or drive. He just seems to be lazy. He just doesn't have any drive about him. Or maybe it's his complaint toward her. Or maybe it's their tempers flare. None of that would happen if they denied themselves. And on the down the line you could go, maybe she's not a keeper at home. She would be if she denied herself. They stand off to see who gives in first. Maybe no patience with the other. Maybe he's a know-it-all, or maybe there's no appreciation for what the other makes. As you go on and on, list 100 other problems. And every one of them will come down to the idea that one or both parties are not denying themselves. Can you think of a marriage problem that doesn't come because of a lack of self-denial? You practice the principle of self-denial, and that resolves a lot of marriage problems. I'm not a counselor, and I'm not in the counseling business. Don't intend to be. But I do have people from time to time come to you, to me, because I am a preacher, and they talk to you about marriage problems. And in recent years, I've not dealt with a single problem yet that I could not identify that one or both were not denying themselves. One or both of them were not denying themselves. In some cases, it's both of them. They're neither one of them denying themselves. It's a standoff. But in other cases, it may be him. In other cases, it may be her. But in every case, in the last few years I've dealt with, it's always been a case of one or both parties not denying themselves. The one last thing we want to talk about is learning to communicate. When we make our commitment to God, we deny ourselves and learn to communicate. And then we can resolve our marriage problems. Now, there are Bible passages that give us an implication that there's a need for communication. Now, there's no passage in the Bible that tells me communicate with your wife or communicate with your husband, but there are some things that I cannot do unless there is some communication. For example, 1 Peter 3:7. Husbands, dwell with your wife according to understanding. How can you do that if you don't communicate with your wife and your wife communicate with you? Or Matthew chapter 19, that they are two now one flesh. How can they be one flesh and view themselves as one? And how can they cleave to each other unless they communicate with each other? How can he properly lead and how can she properly submit unless there's leadership? You see, any of those passages tell me there's a need for communication. I want to suggest to you 5 essentials to communication. And anyone who is an effective communicator with reference to their mates or with their friends or whoever it may be, or maybe it's in business that you effectively communicate with people, you will have these 5 ingredients, you will have these 5 principles. Let's talk about each one of those. First of all, we need to learn to listen. Effective communication is learning to listen. James said, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak. We quote that many times in a context of talking about how we need to control our tongues and we need to be slow to speak. But the passage also says we need to be swift to hear. And open our ears and listen. Listening involves far more than letting it go in one ear and out the other. Listening with the intent of understanding where the other person is coming from. That's communication. You don't always have to agree with them to understand. And so when there is some difference, you listen to your mate with the intent of understanding where your mate is coming from and why they're saying what they're saying. You don't always have to agree, but listen with the intent of understanding. Listen with the attitude that I want to know what you're saying and I want to understand what you're saying. And maybe I'll agree when I understand. Matthew 7:12 would demand that because we're to treat other people the way we want to be treated. That certainly applies to the marriage relationship, doesn't it? As you would have been to you, do even so to them, for this is the law and the prophets. If I want my mate to listen to me with the intent of understanding, then I need to listen to them. Here's a second principle, and that is I need to talk. We need to learn to talk. That's part of the principle of communication, talking with each other. Talking involves far more than just giving them an earful and telling them what for. But it involves speaking so that you are not misunderstood. It means you speak and you talk in a way to clarify things that you've said, things that you've done, so that there's no misunderstanding. And you may find that some of your differences are just merely a misunderstanding. That's true in any relationship. I've noticed that among brethren sometimes. When there are differences within a local church, that sometimes it's just a misunderstanding between the parties. Sometimes it's just a misunderstanding between two people. And long after I moved to a church to work with them, in fact, I hadn't even unpacked my boxes that had moved in the house. Just a day or two after I moved in here came some brethren, and they were at odds, and they wanted me to help resolve their differences. And I thought, hold me. And we sat down and began to talk, and I began to get this one to, I want you to talk and tell your side of the story, and I tell the other one, you stay quiet and just listen. Don't interrupt. When that one got through, we just reversed that. Now you talk and you listen now. And that's about all I did. And they begin to talk and they begin to communicate and to clarify. And when they talk, they resolve their differences and they thank me for it. I didn't do anything. All they did was simply communicate. And once they started communicating, they found out their differences were just misunderstandings. Here's a third principle involved in communication. I might add, though, on this matter of talk. Talk things through and let your thoughts be known. You don't clam up and you don't avoid subjects. You don't avoid sensitive areas, but you let your thoughts be known. How often have I seen husbands and wives discussing something and one say to the other, "I didn't know you felt that way"? Why didn't they know that? Because they had not effectively communicated their thoughts to each other. But here's the third principle: be calm. There's two or three proverbs I want us to notice along the line. Let's turn to Proverbs, the 29th chapter and verse 22. Notice Proverbs 29. The Proverbs is filled with passages that deal with dangers of our use and misuse of the tongue and the things that we say. And Proverbs 29 and verse 22 says, "An angry man stirs up strife, and a furious man abounds in transgression." That is, an angry man abounds in transgression, or a furious man abounds in transgression, and an angry man stirs up strife. When you're upset and you're angry and you're mad, that's not the time to try to communicate. Back off and calm down. And be calm in your relationship and be calm in your communication. And that goes much further. I've noticed that even among brethren. When brethren were mad at each other and they try to communicate while they're mad, they express something they don't intend to express. And they don't get very far and they wonder, "Why? I don't understand. Nobody listens to me." Calm down and people will listen. Be calm in your relationship and dealing with your mate. Let's turn to Proverbs 25 now, if you will. Proverbs 25 and verse 28. "He who has no rule over his own spirit is like a city broken down without walls." If you don't control your temper, you're laying yourself open to destruction. And then Proverbs 20 and verse 3, I love this one. It says, "It is honorable for a man to stop striving, since any fool can start a quarrel." You see, any fool can get mad and start a fuss. And so what's accomplished by that? Well, any fool can do that. But it takes someone of wisdom and understanding that when there is a difference and a problem, just to calm down and to calmly discuss their differences. Here's the fourth principle, and that is to be kind in the relationship. "Let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt," Colossians chapter 4 and in verse 6. Be kind. Things that you say, be kind to your mate. Speak kindly and gently to your mate. And add to that principle, last of all, to be fair in our discussions with each other. That is, no unjustified conclusions or accusations. Have you ever said to your mate, "All you ever want is..." Wait a minute, is that fair? "All you ever want?" Or, "You don't ever..." Then you tell them whatever it is that you think they don't ever do. We tend to exaggerate like that and we make unfair accusations. And that makes for ineffective communication. Like a brother who objected one time in a business meeting to supporting a particular gospel preacher. Whatever the objection was, it was either too much money or it may have been the objection that we could not afford it. Whatever the problem was, he objected to supporting one particular preacher. And so some brethren then charged, "He's opposed to supporting preachers. He's against supporting of preachers." Now, wait a minute, is that fair? You see how unfair that is in dealing with brethren. We have those same kind of accusations in the marriage relationship sometimes. We make charges to our mate that are unfounded, for which there is no basis. Marriage involves two people. There will be problems. Marriage involves God, so there are answers to the problems. When we learn to have our commitment directed toward God, a commitment toward a mate being glued or welded to them, deny ourselves and effectively communicate, then there will be some answers to those problems, and we'll work those problems out. That doesn't mean never will there be any problems to arise. Even though you're committed to God and committed to your mate, and you deny yourself and you effectively communicate, there will be some differences arise because there are two people now involved. But you point yourself back to God being involved in that marriage relationship, and you'll recognize there are answers to those problems. There may be one or more present tonight who's not a Christian, who's not a child of God. Do you believe Jesus to be the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins, confess your faith in Christ, and be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins? If you're subject in any way, would you come while together we stand?